The Ross family entrusted the life of their husband and father, Jason, who had tested positive for COVID, to the care of a hospital. Jason ultimately passed away. Today, Jason's story.
This is Truth to Ponder with Bob Bierman.
And I welcome you to this very special edition of Truth to Ponder for this Tuesday. Now, on yesterday's program, we shared the story from Minnesota of a woman who lost her healthy 70-year-old dad to the COVID protocols that were forced in place by arrogant government authorities, protocols that have since been proven not to work and even be dangerous. Today, we want to share the story of a husband and father of three from Georgia, 36 years of age, who lost his life to these insane policies. So who was Jason? Jason was a Marine veteran. He did three tours in Iraq in 2003 through 2009. He was actually a driver finding and picking up the bodies of his fellow soldiers in Iraq. And then he also served in mortuary services. Jason literally gave his life for our freedoms when he was held captive as a prisoner of war in a Georgia hospital. Now, according to his family, he was one of the kindest and most gentle, caring men, husband, son, brother, and father in the world. This world, as they said, was a much better place with him in it. Jason was he would give a complete stranger the shirt off his back, his last drink, a plate of food. He was hardworking, family-oriented, and he deserved a lot better than he received. Now, since the summer of 2020, this radio program has exposed the lies, the fraud, the needless deaths caused by this man-made pathogen. We can never just forget and move on. Those who did this to us must be fully held accountable for what they knowingly did for financial, political, and even globalist gains. So today, I welcome Brianna McDowell Ross, the widow of Jason Ross, to Truth to Ponder, to share her painful story. So, Brianna, I welcome you to the program, and let me ask this question to start. When did you first realize there was something wrong in the way your husband was being treated when you got him to the hospital?
There are actually so many things, but the first thing was probably when I called. Well, first they said I couldn't go back with him in isolation, which I already kind of knew. So that wasn't a shock, but it was that I told them I had slept with him the night before. We've been in the same bed every night. So that was kind of a red flag, but it was really when I called, I went home and I called, and then I said, okay, I need to pick my husband up and I need to bring him home, back home, because, you know, things weren't what I thought they were going to be. And the woman said, ma'am, your husband is not coming home tonight. Just like that. Yeah. And I was like, okay. That was like, what? When did they start talking to patients like the patients' families like this? And
I know. I've heard a lot of that.
My husband? And why could I not? What?
So you bring him to the hospital, and then you want to bring him home, and they're saying he's not coming home. And you were, I'm going to assume you were not allowed to see him, correct?
Correct. As soon as they gave him the COVID test.
Yeah. Once the COVID coding is in, then everything changes on a dime, correct?
Correct. Then they took him back and said I couldn't go back with him, and then I did not see him again until, you know, he was behind, connected to a bunch of machines, and it was later, way later.
How long was he in the hospital?
18 days.
18 days. So let's kind of go through this process. I know it's hard to do, but it needs to be said, because I do not want people to forever forget what they did to real families, real individuals. There are children that lost their dad. There are young kids that will not have a father. There are people that died way before their time, unnecessarily, in my opinion. And they want us now to, well, we got to move on. And we may have made some mistakes, but, you know, let's forgive and forget and pretend it never happened. No, there were enough warning flags out there, enough people trying to speak up. And it's the same establishment that shut people down trying to say this is wrong. It's time that they're held accountable. So kind of run through what happened. When COVID hit your house, kind of walk us through it.
Okay. I mean, we went, you know, the first year and a half without any of us being sick. And my husband was going to work every day. So he still had to continue working. They didn't have like the technology to work from home or anything. So he had to go in. So it wasn't until this was like September, the end of September, that one of the kids got sick. And then it was me. And then it was my another kid, and then my husband, and then my other kid. So like all of it, and then my mom, and she lives next door. So we all got sick kind of staggered. So about a week after I got sick, my husband got sick. And so I was still, you know, kind of out of it and still not 100%, but so I was still kind of sick. But I was trying to take care of him and the kids. And then he ended up going back to work that Monday, because that was a weekend. And so, you know, his work, I don't know. It might have been too soon. And, but he called me the next day. So the first night he went back to work, he was okay. He was like, you know, I don't feel 100%, but I'm fine going back to work tomorrow. Went back the next day, and then called me and said, I feel terrible. I had to sleep in my car the past 2 hours. And I'm like, can you make it home? He made it home. But then I was like, you're not going back to work until you're 100%. So I start nursing him and trying to do it, take care of him at home. And I used all the things that I used for myself and my kids and my mom. And we didn't have to go to the doctor. And remember, this was the time when they were saying, don't go to the doctor. Don't go to the doctor. Stay home, unless your oxygen drops below, you know, 90, whatever. And then you need to go to the hospital. I mean, that was the instructions we were given at that time. So we, you know, were avoiding that, but I thought I had everything at home, kind of the frontline doctors at the time.
Yep.
Now it's like the full frontline critical care alliance now, that they have too, that following those protocol, like the vitamins and all that.
Yeah, so, C, D, and zinc were very prevalent.
Yes, and quercetin is like for the zinc absorption. And then I actually had those chlorine dioxide drops as well, and I was using those. I didn't have any ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine at the time. So,
which was hard to get in 2021 and 2020.
Exactly. So, you know, no one would prescribe it to me, and I didn't know anyone. I didn't know how to get it then. I thank God I do now. But yeah, so the MMS drops is what I call them. But the chlorine dioxide, actually, it worked really well, I think. So that was what we were using with the vitamins. And nasal rinse, like I highly recommend the neti pots, because I just remember it was so much congestion in my nose. But so we were all okay. He went a different direction. My husband went a different direction than any of us had gone. And again, or not again, I also have asthma, it's just important to say. So I had been hospitalized in my childhood quite often, because seasons change. At the seasons, you know, twice a year, I would always get really sick, and it would go into my lungs. It would be upper respiratory. And a lot of times I would have to go to the hospital, because it was at a time the doctor's office was closed. And so I was hospitalized like once or twice a year for many years. And so I knew the protocol for, you know, like pneumonia and upper respiratory. It was always an antibiotic, a steroid, and albuterol nebulizer treatment. And that was every single time. I mean, like for decades, I mean, and so I had the antibiotic. I actually had a set of antibiotics, at home, cause I guess it was a set I didn't take previously. So, I was like, good, I have that. But I didn't have a steroid. I had nebulizer, albuterol, but I did not have steroid. And so he seemed to, he was okay, but I got one of those pulse oximeters, which I'm actually very, I wish I would, anyway, one of those things that I wish I wouldn't have done, but because we had never used those before. It's not like we were constantly taking oxygen every day, you know? So I just decided to start then and then freak out when it goes below. And his actually got in the low 80s. And so, you know, fear took over. I had tried other options and other things, and they all fell through. I mean, I had infusion people that could come to our house and do like the high dose vitamin C and different things. Well, they were like, one of the ladies was sick, and they, anyway, it totally fell through. No, it was impossible to get anything, any type of treatment. And finally I was like, okay, we need to go somewhere because it was below 85 and it had stayed there for a little while, and he had just done a nebulizer treatment. So we went to we went to the clinic at like Walgreens and walked back because I had gone there before for upper respiratory things and I had gotten treated. Mm-hmm. And she took one look at us and she looked at him and said, "Oh no, look at him. He needs to go to the hospital." And I was like, "What?" And she said, "Do you see him?" And I was like, "Yes, I see him. I brought him here." And anyway, she was really rude and said she wouldn't see him. So we went. He had to go all the way, walk back up. He could barely breathe. I mean, I was so mad that we had walked through that long store. But so the next place we stopped was the urgent care. And I had him stay in the car, went in, told him about his insurance as VA. He's, you know, veteran. He's a Marine veteran. And so they said, "Oh, no, we can't see him because we don't take that insurance." And I said, "Okay, well, forget the insurance. I'll pay out of pocket. You know, he needs to be seen."
That's right.
And they're like, oh no, we can't do that either because now we know he's got the insurance." And I'm like, oh my God.
I mean, to me, let's stop right here for a second. That is one of the craziest things I've ever heard. We can't take your cash because he has insurance. Now, where in the law does it say you can't take their cash because you have insurance?
I have no idea.
I would be for finding out because there's something about all of this, the protocols, the things that were said, things that were done by clinics, doctors, especially corporately owned hospitals and corporately owned practices, that to me this day just don't pass the smell test. And I'm sure, because I already know, your husband was not vaccinated, so he was probably treated worse than a leper.
Yep. Yes. And definitely. And you know what? You reminded me, I did want to follow up with that urgent care and find out what this rule exactly is, because that was just so ridiculous. As I'm telling the story now, I'm like, oh yeah, I need to do that. So yes, when we, you know, I don't really know. All I know is from what they told me. I got to go in there once. So after he was taken, I mean, he was literally like kidnapped. I couldn't get him out.
You know, I've heard that term. I've heard that term kidnapped more than once with people that I've spoken to, people that I've written to and written back to me. They felt like their loved one was taken, kidnapped, never to be seen again. And you were never allowed to see them. Never. Some people will tell you that they had their cell phones taken away or put where they couldn't get to them. And you just were incommunicado for the duration because you were not supposed to know anything. We know best for you. How dare you challenge the science? We know it. You don't. Now shut up. Take your vaccine. Do as we tell you. And you stay away and we'll handle it all. So continue. Yep. So you were now at the clinic. Yes. Said we can't touch him. So off to the hospital he had to go, correct?
Correct. Okay. So yes. Well, yeah. Cause I took one look at him and his color in his face, everything. I was like, he can't breathe. He had told me, he felt like he was in another dimension than I remember. So now I found out mm-hmm. that that's hypoxia, you know,
yes.
you don't have enough oxygen. So, yeah. So that's when I was like, okay, I got to take him to the hospital. But I said, okay, you know, I had read stuff about what they did to him, but I was like, well, but I've never met anyone personally that's ever happened to. Like, I don't know anyone. So is this just one of those, you know, this is when the information was so, everything was, what's misinformation? What's truth? You know, at this time, it was so hard. And I was like, you know, this might just be one of those really conspiracy theories that might just be, I don't know, farce. So I don't know. I didn't know. I thought, I was thinking, oh, it's probably propaganda because this is my community. These are my neighbors. What I didn't know about the traveling nurses and the FEMA nurses at the time. So, and I guess we could talk about that in a minute. So we get there and I knew, and I also had been doing research, though. I did know about remdesivir and I knew about the ventilators. And I said, well, as long as I'm with them, I'm just going to stand there and advocate. And I would not even sign the form to admit him until I said, I'm not signing this until I know for sure because they said, for treatment, will you sign this for treatment? And I said, what is the treatment? Well, it just depends on what he needs. I said, no, I need to make sure that the treatment is not going to include remdesivir or a ventilator. And the girl just looked like,
How dare you? pretty much.
Yes. Actually, this girl just looked like she had no idea what I was talking about. Like, she was so confused. She had to get someone else. And that's when, you know, yeah, people were like, oh, yeah, one of these, you know. And then this nurse came up. She goes, no, it's okay, honey. He just probably needs some oxygen. That's all. And I was like, okay. All right. So I signed it. And so then they took him to triage and did all his vitals and stuff and got him oxygen. We sat out in the lobby and even one of the guys out in the lobby said, oh, yeah, man, you look so much better now. Your face was so white before. Now you've got color. So I was like, good. You know, he's got oxygen. Now we're good. We can go. You know, and they called him back, and that's when they did the COVID test. And then I didn't see him again after that. So that was the last time I had seen him and sat with him. So, yes, I had to pick up the kids at school, and so I left, picked them up, went home, and I went next door, told my mom, and she was like, wait, what? You left him there? And I was like, yeah, she's like, you have to go get him. So that's when I called to say, okay, I'm coming to get my husband. And she told me, no, ma'am, your husband's not coming home tonight. And I just thought it was a very weird way of saying, you know, it was just the choice of communication and the choice of words was very strange. And then I kept calling. I wanted to talk to, on every shift, I was like, what medication is he on? I'm trying to find out exactly everything. Oh, because I also asked them before I left the hospital, okay, well, I would like to, how do I keep up with his chart online? I would like to keep up with this chart, you know, whenever I want to, like log on. And they said, oh, yeah, you can't do that until he's discharged. Because the my chart is only for patients, like non-emergency patients.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, my goodness. So I was literally going by whoever I was talking to every time I called and what they would tell me. And I have a notebook full of notes. I mean, I took meticulous notes every time I talked to someone, got their name, time, date, every single thing they said. I asked them list every single medication he is on right now. And I mean, I was trying, and this girl told me an R named, I forget what it was, I haven't written down, but it was an R named something, but it was really remdesivir, but she said it wrong. And I even repeated it to her. She said it again. And so I'm like, okay, I don't know what that is. And she's like, I think it's just some sort of, she didn't even know what it was. And so I didn't find out he had already been given remdesivir. And then once we've gone through the medical records, just to say, it says in the medical records, he had acute kidney injury on admission, which they never told me that. And the doctor wrote, patient is not a candidate for remdesivir. But then they started him on remdesivir the next day with two doses. And then...
Unbelievable.
They did it 5 days.
You know, it seems like there was just, you had to put him on remdesivir and a ventilator as soon as you possibly could. And anything else was verboten. You couldn't do it. Now, as I recall from your story, he was there, 3 days? And that was that coincided with your wedding anniversary. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
And you were allowed a short visit. So what happened with that visit?
Oh, yeah. So when I went in, I actually had to put the armor of God. I sat in the car for a while, praying and putting the armor of God on, because I just knew the evil in that hospital. It's indescribable. I could feel it, you know. But so I went in, though, with a great attitude. I was trying to be my normal peppy, positive self. And I was like, hi, how are you doing? And the nurse, she looked right at me, tilted her head down and looked over her glasses and said, if you try to go through that door, I'm calling security. I was like, whoa, I wasn't, okay, that wasn't what I came here to do, but okay. And so then I see my husband, he's through the glass, it's like glass walls and glass door.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw my very strong, manly husband there, and it just looked like that he was not that sick at all. And they were trying to make him looked sicker than he was. If that makes any sense. Like, it sounds unbelievable, but I kept having to pinch myself because this whole experience, I kept feeling like I was in a dream, a nightmare, another dimension myself. And because they were just like emasculating him, you know, and they were just, oh yeah, look. So they kept doing things. I was noticing that was making his stats go down, you know, like they'd do something.
That's
like
right. You could see, you could see the monitor on him at that point through the glass, correct? Yeah. So you're able to see the oxygen level and everything else that's going on through the window. Am I right?
Exactly. And all I kept seeing was every time he had a dip down or anything went wrong, it was from them and their interventions. And I already, so that was another huge, I was like, oh, wow, this is way worse than I thought. And I was even asking the respiratory, I was asking as many questions as I could too. And I was asking the respiratory therapist about the prone position, because I have a friend that was a respiratory therapist, and I knew that information. Being prone is being on your stomach, and that's actually better for breathing than being on your back. They had him like on his back. And she, the respiratory therapist, when I asked her about it, she was like, oh yeah, that doesn't matter. His position doesn't matter. Oh my goodness. And then I was like, well, are y'all gonna open a window or take him outside, you know, he's sunlight and front, you know, ground with nature. So they're like, they laughed at me, you know. And then the pulmonologist came out, and he you know, it was just, I had already talked to him on the phone
now
once,
remember that. Now this is October of 2021, so in your part of the world, in Georgia, south of Atlanta, the weather is rather nice. I mean, it would be wonderful to get some fresh air at that time of the year. The colors are not even just beginning to even change, and the weather is still delightful. Not too hot, not too cold. I used to live in Peachtree City years ago, so I know the area where you live and that region. So I'm thinking, man, that would be great. Sunshine, natural, you know, vitamin D coming in, and fresh air it would be great for a respiratory disease like COVID-19. But no, they kept him in the room, and what else did they then do?
Yes. Yeah, so they kept him in the room, and I saw a nurse go in and put an IV, another IV with him, and I was just thinking, oh my God, is that remdesivir? For some reason, it popped in my head, and I was like, why would I think that? Well, so when the pulmonologist came up, I had already talked to him on the phone once, and I had already asked him about ivermectin, monoclonal antibodies, hydroxychloroquine.
And they said no, no, and no, I bet.
Oh, yeah, and he had an excuse for every single one, and had these ridiculous things. I even ended up calling another doctor out on studies. And anyway, he said, and then I even said, you know, but I heard that y'all get incentives. Because you get this much money if you put him on a ventilator. You get this much money. I told him that, and he said, oh, ma'am. He's like, he was from Guatemala or something. So he was Hispanic. He's like, oh, ma'am, we are not in the business of killing people for money.
You want to bet? The evidence stacks up in the reverse. I'm sorry to tell you.
Yeah, I couldn't even believe it. I'm like, you actually said it in your... anyway, he said it out loud in those words, And then he was getting really frustrated with me that he's like, well, he's not going on the ventilator because of you. And I'm like,
and it's your fault that he's not getting better because he's not on a ventilator. From what I understand,
exactly,
from reading the history about this, they'd given him Xanax. They had him on remdesivir. So now he's weak. He's tired. He's run down. And he's alone.
He didn't take medications. And he never, like, did. He was, you know, very clean, you know, cut guy. Like, he didn't even smoke. Like, he never did anything like that, but definitely no medication. So his tolerance to anything like that was so low. And, you know, they give you like maximum in hospitals, but so I could tell, at that point, I don't know, that they had him on Xanax, but it was like, I think still that it was that day, because they said, you know, he kept trying to take off his mask. Well, of course, like, I do my nebulizer. I actually had some breathing issues this week, so I had to use it again. And I was thinking about this the other day. It was like, I have to take breaks. I've been doing that since I was a little kid and used it. It's like, I have to, like, after a few minutes, I'll turn it off, and I'll take some deep breaths, and I'll breathe regular air, and then I'll go back to it because it's harsh. But the the harshness of that oxygen just plowing into their lungs. I've learned more about that now too. And that's, it's just insane. So of course, when they're trying to take their mask off, they're like, what I do with my mask, like you're trying to take a little break, take a little break from that pounding oxygen. But instead they said he was nervous and they gave him Xanax. And that was when he told me, so let me go back to when I was there on the wedding anniversary, the day before the wedding anniversary, after that talk with the pulmonologist. And then I said, so he's not on remdesivir, right? And he said, oh, I'm not supposed to tell you. He actually said that verbatim. And I said, wait, he's on remdesivir? He was like, he told me not to tell you. So, I mean, and that's something my husband would not do. And I'm like, oh, wow. So I just know he didn't have informed consent. He didn't know about that. And so then they asked, it didn't go the way he wanted. He took his gloves off and he like balled them up and threw them right over my head. I was standing against the wall and they hit the wall and slid down into the trash can. And I only give those details because just to set the mood, like it was really strange. It was stressed.
I'll put it that way.
Yes, exactly. And then they were like, okay, you need to go now. So I think that my trip had not gone the direction that they wanted it to go. So I had, in the meantime, like I even filmed the hospital like, as I was walking out, because I was like, okay, if we come back to break in, I'm already like plotting, like, okay, we might have to break him out of here. So I was trying to think. I was like, I can't do it right now because I don't. And I'm running through this like, do I open the door and do I take? And so, but I was like, he was connected to all these machines. So I decided, and I figured security, they might call there's police. The security is actually police. The sheriffs are out there and stuff at the hospital. So I'm like, I can't be arrested. My kids need me. They can't be missing both parents. So I went home and I said, okay, we're going to figure this out. And we called all these places trying to figure out. I was like, we got to get him out of there. And so there is a thing, the AMA, which is against medical advice, where you can leave the hospital. Well, every time he asked for that, they would send their team of doctors and nurses to come in and tell him, explain to him, oh, why that was such a good idea. And that he didn't know, you know, then I didn't know that where was my medical degree from? Oh, she's just a conspiracy theorist. They were gaslighting.
Exactly.
Him so bad.
Exactly. And they did that to how many thousands, hundreds of thousands of patients across this country were gaslighted and lied to. They were starved, left thirsty, never really treated, and they were put on the moneymakers. The things like remdesivir, moneymaker, ventilator, moneymaker, protocol, the test, moneymaker. It wasn't about getting somebody better. It was trying to run everything that makes the money for the hospital that couldn't have any patients at that time, probably still, because of COVID, they were still postponing things. And so this became... I'm sorry to say it. This is my opinion, and people can disagree, but I think it became financially driven. The incentive was just too high and too tempting to pass up. And a lot of companies, they knew that if they didn't participate, they could lose their insurance rights and everything else. So there was some serious threats on these hospitals and these clinics.
Yep. And that's why, They were gaslighting him. They were basically turning him against me. And then they had him on those machines, and he would be like, I can't talk. So I couldn't even talk to him, you know. And then they wouldn't let him take the break, like I told you. And they had I have text messages, and I've kept all of them. I've got them all saved and backed up, like that. Of them, I'm starving. I'm so thirsty. I've hit the button so many times. Can you call the nurse? Can you call the hospital and get the nurse? I've got so many texts like that. But that night that I went, they said he ate. It was his first meal. He ate a full meal. He was fine. He had his mask off. He went back down to the CPAP, BiPAP, instead of the high flow nasal cannula. He went back to the... Or maybe it's vice versa, whatever the lower one was. And all that, he was great. I even have a picture of his stats that next day, which was a Sunday, on our actual anniversary. And I was like, great. But it was a weekend, so it was hard to get companies. I was trying to find, like, home health care, just to be able to get, like, oxygen and maybe get a nurse, you know. And that kind of stuff, just to make sure he was okay. I was trying to figure out, like, pick up, get transportation, and then that. But all of it was really hard to do on the weekends, but we were still trying. We made so many calls, and we tried so many things, and I said, look, I could just bring the van up, and I'll bring your CPAP machine, because he had sleep apnea, so I had a CPAP machine, and I'm like, if anything, since that's basically what they have you on, I'll have it plugged in the van, and I'll come pick you up, and we'll just go. Like, I had all the, and he said that day was the day they gave him that Xanax. That's what it was. And that's when, because he goes, oh, no, it's okay. I'll just stay another night. Don't worry about it. And I was like, okay, that's weird. And but once I got the medical records, I knew that was when they started him hot and heavy on the Xanax. So, and then they ended up talking him into the ventilator from there over the next couple of days. And I kept asking them, tell me how medically, because this is nonsense. Like, I've never heard of something so ridiculous in my life. I've had respiratory issues my whole life, and this is nothing. This is foreign to me. Like, what are you? And I'm like, explain to me, like, I'm five. How is this going to help heal him? And talking about the ventilator. And, you know, laying there, not moving, you know, all the opposite of things that you're supposed to do when you got a respiratory. And they said, he's been working so hard, his heart and his lungs, they've been, they're just go in so fast. So this will just help him rest. He'll be able to rest and give his lungs a rest, and his body won't have to be working, doing everything else so that he can heal. About giving his lungs a rest.
Brianna, we need to take a little break, and I want you to come back with me on the other side of this break to continue your story. My guest today is Brianna McDowell Ross. She's the widow of Jason Ross, 36 years young, father of three, died because of COVID protocols in a Georgia hospital. And we're exposing this week some of these families, so we do not forget what happened to us. We began the radio program Truth to Ponder. It all started because of the lies being told about COVID, things that were suspicious about an election, and the many things that are happening to take away your freedom, to gaslight you and lie to you. And most important, to share the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ along the way as part of what we do. If you believe in our mission and ministry, would you consider supporting us? You can visit our website, truth2ponder.com, truth2ponder.com, or make a check or money order payable to Ancient Word Radio, Ancient Word Radio, Post Office Box 510, Post Office Box 510, Chilhowie, 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 Virginia, zip code 24319. Once again, Ancient Word Radio, Post Office Box 510, Chilhowie, Virginia, zip code 24319. And we will be right back.
This is Truth to Ponder with Bob Bierman.
The dance of the electrons. Coming up. Shalom Aleichem. This is the nice Jewish boy, your Jewish connection, Jonathan Kahn, bringing you the riches of your Jewish roots in Jesus. Now get your pen out as fast as you can so you don't miss out on receiving a special free gift you're going to get and love in a moment. When you look at the largest of things, you see a pattern. The moon revolves around the earth around the sun revolves around the center of the Milky Way. But as you go smaller, you see the same thing also. The smallest of things, the atom. Around the nucleus of the atom is the electron. From the electron, we get electricity and magnetism and everything else, radiation. But what does the electron do? It does the same thing that the moon does and the earth does and the sun does. The electron revolves around the center. Amazing. This pattern goes from the very largest to the smallest. And what's it saying? It's that everything revolves around something else. Everything has to revolve around something greater than itself. Moons, planets, stars, electrons, something else. Man, each of us. See, the way of existence is not just to exist. It's to revolve around what is greater. So you can't just live. You can't just be. You can't just live for yourself. You have to revolve around something greater. That something greater is God. See, if you live your life centered on yourself, you'll never know life. But if you live your life not centered on yourself and let go of it, but around Him, then everything in your life is going to fall into place. It's the way of the universe. What is worship? It's centering your life around Him who's greater than you. It's in Hebrew, The word for worship is, one of the words, is to dance in a circle, revolve. So the dance of the electrons, so the dance of the Hebrews is the flow of life. Revolve your life around him, your dreams around him, your focus, your ways, your worship, your will, your everything around him. And you will be blessed from the electron to the greatest galaxy. This is the way of creation and the dance of life. Want more? Ask for the Gospel of the Moons on CD. Now, how'd you like to be faster than a bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound? How about just move mountains? You can with Sapphire's, the super spiritual supplement to turn your walk into a super life with God. Plus the incredible Mystery of the Temple Doors on CD, all free. How do you get all this? Easy. Just remember Jesus' real Hebrew name, Yeshua, and you dial it. So to receive your gift, just call now, 1-800-YESHUA-1. You will be blessed, but call now, 1-800-YES-HUA-1. I invite you to join me in the Great Commission to bring salvation back to the Jewish people who gave you the gospel and reach millions of unreached peoples around the world on five continents. It's amazing. Through shortwave radio, you can blanket the earth. How? Just call 1-800-YESHUA-1. That's YESHUA-1. Or you can write me direct. The Nice Jewish Boy at Box 1111, Lodi, L-O-D-I, New Jersey, 07644. That's Box 1111, Lodi, New Jersey, 07644. Till next time, this is Jonathan Kahn saying, Shalom Aleichem. Peace be to you, my friend, in Messiah, Hasar Shalom, the Prince of Peace.
This is Truth to Ponder with Bob Bierman.
And I welcome you back to part two of this very special Tuesday edition of Truth to Ponder. As we take the time to remember those that needlessly died during the COVID pandemic, not from the disease COVID, but from the way they were treated. And this has been a very sore spot for me since we started this program and watched some of the insanity that was pushed on us into the hospitals by government and people that really should know better. And really what is angering to me is the many countless doctors that stood up, and they were suppressed, they were silenced, they were deplatformed. Some even lost their medical licenses, yet they were proven right in the long run. And there's a tale of death and injury out there that the world seems to want to move forward from and forget it ever even happened. We cannot simply forget and move on. We must hold those that did this to us accountable. I welcome back to the program my guest, Brianna McDowell Ross, the wife of Jason Ross. I know this, telling the story is not easy. You are working hard trying to be the advocate for your husband. And I want you to pick up where we left off before we went to the break and kind of share the things that occurred next in your fight to keep your husband alive and fighting these protocols.
Well, I tried to get the AMA. I tried to get that again. He tried to ask for it again. They kept doing the same stuff, gaslighting and all that. Wouldn't let him leave. The patient advocate at the hospital, same thing. She was like, oh, well, you know, she was supposed to help me to get that AMA signed. And then she was like, call me. Oh, you know, the doctor wants to talk to you. And that's what my husband kept saying. The doctor wants to talk to you. So I'm like, no. So then I asked, okay, I said, I'm coming to get him, you know, whatever. And one of the nurses said, if you come, what we're going to have to do, she goes, we'll have to unhook him from all the machines. He's going to have to get himself dressed, you know, when he hasn't even walked, you know, in a week or whatever, a few days, and walk down, get himself dressed, walk down this very long corridor all the way down to the elevator, go down like four stories, then walk further to find me because I wasn't allowed to bring a wheelchair. I wasn't allowed to go up.
Yeah, notice when a hospital wants to discharge you, they put you in a wheelchair for their, you know, protection. Yes. So you don't sue them. But no, if you're a COVID patient and somebody wants to get you out, you're on your own. And exactly. and they put the guilt trip on you.
Exactly. They said, we can't give him a wheelchair. Yep, you're exactly right. So anyway, I said, oh my goodness. Like, I was just against every wall. I said, I've tried everything. Like, I did. And I said, I there's nothing else I could do. And then, you know, this nurse was just like, oh, I would, anyway, he ended up saying, you know, I'm exhausted, I'm tired, I just want to do this. He's like, I just want to get better so I can come home. And that's actually what he told my son, like, just be a few days, let me just do this so I can get better and come home. I want to be done with this. You know, that was what, so I said, okay, babe, you know, if that's, I've tried to fight, like, you know, I was like, I guess, because I'm also just still raising three kids, you know, by myself and trying to keep our lives going at the same time as trying to do all this. And so, and they knew that. So they put him on the ventilator, and he actually was doing really good. And he was about to get off the ventilator about 3 days later. He was weaning off, and he was almost completely off the ventilator. And they said that he had like this hiccup or was like choking, or it is called vagaling is what they told me it was called. But basically they had to do a culture and test him. And they found the next day that he had Pseudomonas, which the doctors told me, his words, hospital acquired infection. And I was livid. We deal with this all the time. It's okay. We got the antibiotic. We've already started him on it. I was so upset, because then from there was when it got real dicey, and it was just, I want to say downhill, but it wasn't even fully downhill. He was fighting. It was, but then there was one night that they called me at 3 a.m. and, said, oh, his heart rate went down, or do you give us permission to do life-saving treatment, or anyway. And then they made it sound like he was,
you know, I've heard that so many times, that they want to do this life-saving treatment. It's always somewhere between 2 and 4 o'clock in the morning when they call. And this is, you're not alone in this. This is a repeated scenario that I've heard more times than I care to discuss, that they wait till you're half asleep. And you're worrying about your loved one, and now you give them a carte blanche card to do anything that they want to do at that point. So what happened next?
Yep. So I said, oh, well, do I need to come up there? She said, I will call you back. And then she didn't. So I had to sleep, though. I remember I was exhausted because I had been going on no sleep. And so I was like, I am so tired. So I slept. And the next morning, this one woman who had been assigned to me the week before when he went on a ventilator, she told me it was called family support care or something, but come to find out now it was like palliative care, but they didn't even call it that. They lied to me about that too, what her position was. But she called me and said, she told me the day before, this other doctor had called. There's just so many things, sorry. But this other doctor, that's what it was. He wanted to ramp everything back up. I'm going to reparalyze him, resedate him. We're going to start all over. And I said, no, I want this all done. I want to take him home. This has gone too far. We're done. And he was like, no. And I said, what about ivermectin? I tried to go back to that. I told him about the Nobel Prize that he just won for human. He said, what's for COVID? And laughed at me. I was like, well, no, obviously not, because COVID is new. But it was just, so I told her that I wanted to fire him. I told the other doctor, he's fired. I don't want him anymore working with my husband. And I want people to listen to me. Y'all need to listen to me now. So she said, she talked me down, and I'll let you know. Don't worry. I'll let you know when it's time to worry. I'm not worried at all. He's doing great.
So well, after getting that paid, that's why they're not worried.
And they called me in the middle of the night thing. So then that happened that night. So then the next day she called me, and she goes, okay, now I'm getting worried. And so she asked me to come up there, and that's when I saw him. That was the next time I saw him, and it had been about a week and a half later. And went up there, and she was also, it was the theatrics. Every time I went up there, it was theatrics and over-dramatizing. And they were showing me x-rays, and I'm like, that looks just like what pneumonia looks like in it. Because they're like, oh, the COVID. I'm like, that's not the COVID. That's the pneumonia that you, so anyway. And then we had a consultation with the doctor. And by then I had found this other advocate, but he was in New Zealand. And he did like patient advocacy from patients to doctors in critical care situations. But his schedule was all off, so I couldn't ever get him on the phone when I got to meet with the doctors. But he did like teach me a few things and help me with a few things, but it wasn't enough. Then let's see, that was Thursday. Friday, I went back up there. Saturday, Sunday, he was doing so good. It was Saturday. He was doing so good. I wasn't allowed up there. See, it was only when they thought he was totally dying that I was allowed up there. And so by Monday, That was the last day. It was the 25th, and actually today is exactly 2.5 years that it happened. It was the 25th of October, and went up there. That was when they called the kidney doctor because, he's going to need this dialysis, and I gave them permission for that. But when I got there, they said, his blood pressure's too low. But, you know, looking at these medical records, it's ridiculous the amount of drugs they have them on. Lower the blood pressure.
And you wonder why the injury to the kidney. It's from what they did to him.
Yeah. I know. Oh, yeah. So they said that was starting to fail or whatever. And then I started talking about getting them moved. So I talked to Emory. I was talking to their hospital. I said, we're getting them transferred. And that's when they upped it. And a bunch of really shady stuff happened. And because I also wouldn't sign a DNR. Every day I was there, they were trying to get me to sign a DNR. And I said, no, you're going to do everything to save my husband. That night, too, the nurse was like, your husband's not going to make it tonight. And I was like, excuse me, you do everything you can to save my husband. I was so mad. And then, he actually came back and he kind of tricked me. Like, they pulled this okie doke of the thing I wanted was like the dialysis type thing, the CRRT thing, and to clean his blood. And I thought that actually could be the thing that helps him and saves him. And then he said, I got permission from the kidney doctor. We can do this. And he was like jumping up in the air, literally. Like, and I was like, why is he so excited? Like, that was weird. Then he prepped him. I agreed to this. I actually had my pastor came up there, thank goodness, and prayed over him and did all that. And so after the pastor came, we did the procedure, and I thought this procedure was going to save his life. Come to find out it was a trap. Because they knew when they flipped him over, he had told me that he's like, I only have to flip him for a second to put the thing in his neck. And then, but I do it all the time. It's fine. That was when his heart stopped. They knew that. So when they flipped him over, his heart stopped. He had come out and got me and said, I want you to come back here. They asked me to come inside the room. I didn't want to, but they talked me into it. And he was literally naked, nothing covering him at this point. And they were giving him CPR. And so you can imagine your naked body, like, and the people giving you CPR, you're shaking all over the place and stuff. And they're just doing that, right? And even these kids that were working there, the medical assistant, like, they looked traumatized. I mean, it was like so traumatizing. And they did this supposedly 15 minutes. They're like, after 15 minutes, you probably shouldn't do it. It's not smart to do this. I don't know. This woman was telling me all this stuff. And I'm like, but you keep trying to save my husband's life. But they called his time of death before I even knew what was, I couldn't believe it. I'm like, you're done. That's it. And that was it. And I just fell on my knees and prayed. So yeah, it was insane. And then the hospital lady was so weird. I think she was the administrator, and she's just staring at me. It was very eerie. There's a lot more details. That was like a horror story. But yeah, I mean, that's enough of a horror story. But if I told you even more of the details and little things, I really need to get it published and put in a movie.
I understand. Brianna, so you lost your husband. And when did you, I know that anytime you lose a spouse, I lost a wife to cancer a number of years ago. And I know that your mind and your body, you're in shock. On top of the days you're spending when they're in the hospital, like you did, you're mentally exhausted. You're spiritually and physically just wasted. And then trying to get through the process of a funeral and all the arrangements. And then the shock that goes on, the anger that goes on, and trying to pull your life back together. At what point did you realize that something was not just wrong, but it was horribly wrong, and you started to, in essence, fight back to get your story out? What triggered that change to let the world know what these evil individuals did to you, your family, and your husband? What was the trigger? And how do we get other people to do the same thing, to never forget that they were the real people attached to these horrible stories? What triggered it all?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that. I just knew. I mean, I knew from that moment, I knew. And then God actually spoke to me right then. I have a lot of God testimonies, but right when I fell on my knees, I said, you know, he told me, I heard or saw, it was a vision, something. It's just a knowing of something huge is happening and your family is right in the middle of it. I'm doing something big. There's something big happening. So I knew, like, I knew from all the series of events in the hospital, but because of all the emotional and the shock and all that, yeah, I couldn't. It took a minute because people were just thinking I'm just this crazy, like, you know, bitter widow, like trying to blame somebody, you know. You know, that's what I felt like at first. But also, I didn't have, but I did. That week, the first thing I did was, I wanted an autopsy. And nobody wanted to do autopsies. So I searched far and wide and finally got one. But he had to sit at the morgue at the hospital until then. But got that. And I meant to tell you about that, too. I'll say in a minute. I got the toxicology, too. But anyway, I knew then, because I was like, I have to get an autopsy. I know there's something wrong. And then I just started looking for lawyers right away. And then I said, wait, I need to handle other business first. I'll come back to the lawyer thing. And then really no attorneys want to touch it with a 100-foot pole. We found a few now. But my friend added me to a Facebook group and said, Bree, it was like a COVID malpractice, it was something about COVID-19, you know, something's not right type of group. And I started talking to and meeting all these other people that had the same story and knew something wasn't right. And that led me into this other group called, it's the COVID Humanity Betrayal Memory Project. Mm-hmm. And it's CHBMP. So it's CHBMP.org is actually the website. But there was a group on Facebook too, the C19 Widows and Widowers. So once we all start talking and sharing our stories and we start realizing, and then the CHBMP they were documenting the stories. So that's actually exactly why this organization was started, was to document the stories. So first of all, the memories are preserved. But second of all, so that, yeah, they can't rewrite history. And we're not going to let them forget about this. Everyone forget about this. So that was the main point of the CHBMP. And the organization is also former Feds Freedom Foundation. CHBMP is underneath that. And so the founder of that, Brad Geyer, was a former federal prosecutor for the Department of Justice for like decades. And then he finally saw the corruption and he's like, I'm going to fight this on the other side. So he started former feds. And then he saw all this coming with COVID. And he's like, we were trying to warn y'all, like we were censored. And so he started this organization. I am actually the state chair of Georgia. So we also have our own separate sites for the states as well. So we've got...
Well, let me ask this. How can people, number one, reach out to you and maybe, even if they're not in Georgia, I've had people from other states, we're doing other interviews from other places, at least connecting to you, even if they live in, let's say, Mississippi or New York, they can connect to their own group. How could they find out more? Because I think this is vital that people research this, whether they've lost a loved one or not. People need to read these stories.
Oh, for sure. So you can read and document your own stories. You can sign up right on the main page when you go to chbmp.org and you can fill out your information. You can just put the basics. You don't have to put all the details. And someone will call you and schedule an interview. And a lot of people are nervous to do the interviews, like, as you know, but it really helps so much like that. First of all, getting my story out for the first time was so therapeutic and healing. And yes, it hurts at first, but it also ends up being more healing, you know. And then they can also email me. So my email I'll give right now is Brianna, Briana dot Ross, Ross, at formerfedsgroup.org. Let me make sure that's right. And so you can also email me directly, and I can definitely put you in connection with your state chair or whatever you need. Because we've also now combined with the former feds is also over that REACT-19, which is for the vax injured from the vaccine. So we work with both. It's hospital protocol victims is more what my focus is, but we also help, there's a whole side of for the vaccine injured. Cause you know, we were all hurt by the same people, and that's what I always tell everyone, you know, we were all hurt by the same people.
Has learning what happened to other people in similar circumstances and trying to fight back, How has that helped you?
Sometimes it was too much reading other people's stories over and over. It was helpful because it was validating, and I was realizing that all these things had happened, and it was helping me remember what happened to my husband, but it was also painful. So I had to do a lot of just me and God time at first, but then I started realizing that I was getting angry, probably about almost a year after it happened. And my therapist said, your anger's spilling out on other people. You got to find a channel to get your anger out. And what actually has worked the best for me was I joined the task force for former feds and CHBMP and started actually taking action against the people that hurt me, you know, and that's what this group has allowed us to do. And it's amazing. Now we've changed. We just passed a bill in Georgia, never alone, no patient left alone. And it's for nursing homes and hospitals. So no patient will ever be alone in a hospital again in Georgia, even whether it's a pandemic or anything. So taking action has helped so much. We're also working with a class action lawsuit and all that in another lawsuit. So that is so therapeutic and healing as well. So I highly recommend join us and help get these guys that hurt us.
My guest today, Brianna McDowell Ross, who lost her husband, Jason, 36 years of age, U.S. Marine war veteran, father of three, to COVID protocols. And I want to thank Brianna for sharing her story with all of us here today. If you missed that website address on how to find out more, you can even find her story there. Let me share it with you. It's pretty simple. The letters CHBMP. That's CHBMP. .org CHBMP.org. And I'll also have it in the show notes for those that listen online or by podcast. We need to keep these stories alive. A lot of people want to simply move on and forget all of this ever happened. We just made mistakes. Yet when confronted and being told some of these ideas were incorrect and wrong, instead of listening and having an open discussion, people were simply shut down, deplatformed, lost their medical licenses. Some of the most bizarre behavior I've ever seen in the United States. And social media like Facebook and back in the day Twitter, they're equally to blame. Google, they should be held accountable because they suppressed the truth and they amplified the lies, and hundreds of thousands of people needlessly died. I'll probably talk about that a little bit more later this week. How many people could have been saved? How many people died needlessly, not of the disease, but of what the protocols pushed by government people? They should be held accountable for what they did. People were hurt and injured. Now, if you believe in this radio program and ministry, we really need your support. Tomorrow begins the month of May, and we are needing your support to stay on shortwave radio. If you'd be so kind, you can go to our website, truth2ponder.com. truth2ponder.com. Look for the page that has support, and you can find out how to give using Give, Send, Go, or you can even mail a check or money order made payable to Ancient Word Radio, Ancient Word Radio, Post Office Box 510. That's Post Office Box 510. The city is Chilhowee, C-H-I-L-H-O-W-I-E, Chilhowee, Virginia. Zip code in Chilhowee is 24319. Once again, Ancient Word Radio, Post Office Box 510, Chilhowee, Virginia. And the zip code in Chilhowee, Virginia is 24319. That's 24319. Once again, I want to thank Brianna for being with us today, and I hope this program meant something to you.
This has been Truth to Ponder with Bob Bierman. To find out more, visit our website, truth2ponder.com. That's truth2ponder.com. Truth to Ponder, shining the light of truth in a darkening world.